Well, we made it. Yep, we made it to the end of 2019.
Another turning point, a fork stuck in the road. Time grabs you by the wrist, directs you where to go. So make the best of this test and don't ask why. It's not a question but a lesson learned in time. It's something unpredictable, but in the end is right. I hope you had the time of your life. So take the photographs and still frames in your mind, hanging on a shelf in good health and good time. Tattoos and memories and dead skin on trial. For what it's worth, it was worth all the while. It's something unpredictable, but in the end is right. I hope you had the time of your life.
It certainly was a year. Come with me for a journey through the last 12 months of the insanity of Donald J. Trump. I'm Nicole Sandler, and for the next hour or so, we'll recap 2019 and bid it good riddance. Obviously, in 1 hour, we can't possibly cover every news story, but I'll do my best to highlight the big ones and others that I think we need to pay more attention to. So strap in. It's a bumpy ride. Here we go.
It's something unpredictable, but in the end it's right. I hope you had the time of your life. It's something unpredictable, but in the end it's right. I hope you had the time of your life.
When 2019 began, the government was closed. It wouldn't reopen until January 25th, after 35 long days, when Donald Trump signed a short-term spending bill providing 3 weeks of stopgap funding while lawmakers were to work on a border security compromise. The effects of the 2018 midterm elections kicked in on January 3rd, when Democrats took back control of the House of Representatives and Nancy Pelosi was sworn in as Speaker of the House for a second time. And Donald Trump held his first cabinet meeting of the year, where he rambled incessantly about things of which he knows nothing. But here's an example, a Trump-splainer on Syria.
Syria was lost long ago. It was lost long ago. And besides that, I don't want, we're talking about sand and death. That's what we're talking about. We're not talking about, you know, vast wealth. We're talking about sand and death. I don't want to be in Syria forever. It's sand and it's death.
In a movie, that would be called foreshadowing, but we'll get there. On January 9th, the 17th day of the shutdown, Trump abruptly stormed out of a negotiating session with Democrats, declaring it a waste of time, before delivering a primetime Oval Office speech to again push his stupid wall.
Mother, do you think they'll try to break my balls?
Not only was the president unpresidential, surprise, surprise, I think the meeting was a setup so he could walk out.
When I would say Mexico's going to pay for it, I never said this and I never meant they're going to write out a check.
Mother, should I run for president?
I have the absolute right to declare a national emergency. I haven't done it yet. I may do it. If this doesn't work out, probably I will do it. I would almost say definitely.
And then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like,
the buck stops with everybody.
January also brought with it 3 mass shootings at a Southern California bowling alley, a Sebring, Florida bank, and one in Louisiana. And it begins, a slew of 2020 presidential contenders stepping up. Julian Castro, Kamala Harris, and Marianne Williamson all embarked on their presidential quests in January. The spigot of candidates kept spewing out contenders in February, with Cory Booker, Tulsi Gabbard, Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar, and Bernie Sanders all making it official. On February 5th, Donald Trump delivered his State of the Union address, marking the halfway point of what will hopefully be his only term in office. During the speech, he announced a second planned summit with Kim Jong-un of North Korea, making up his own facts as he went along.
Part of a bold new diplomacy, we continue our historic push for peace on the Korean Peninsula. Our hostages have come home. Nuclear testing has stopped, and there has not been a missile launch in more than 15 months. If I had not been elected President of the United States, we would right now, in my opinion, be in a major war with North Korea. Much work remains to be done. But my relationship with Kim Jong-un is a good one. Chairman Kim and I will meet again on February 27th and 28th in Vietnam.
Seriously? With the 2018 elections came a plethora of women elected to office. At least 117 women were elected on November 6, 2018. 100 Democrats and 17 Republicans. Of them, 42 are women of color and at least 3 LGBTQ. There are currently 101 women serving in the House, 88 of them Democrats, 13 Republicans, and 25 in the Senate, 18 Democrats, 8 Republicans. In his State of the Union address, Trump inadvertently praised the great strides made, well, by the Democrats.
No one has benefited more from a thriving economy than women, who have filled 58% of the newly created jobs last year. You weren't supposed to do that. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
February was the month in which Donald Trump declared a national emergency at the southern border so he could bypass Congress and build his wall with emergency funds. Attorneys general from 16 states filed a federal lawsuit challenging the declaration, and 10 days later, the House passed a bill rejecting it, though Trump would later veto that. He sort of sang a little song about it in a Rose Garden speech.
So the order is signed. And I'll sign the final papers as soon as I get into the Oval Office, and we will have a national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit, even though it shouldn't be there, and we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court, and hopefully we'll get a fair shake, and we'll win in the Supreme Court, just like the ban. They sued us in the Ninth Circuit, and we lost, and then we lost in the appellate division, and then we went to the Supreme Court, and we won. And it was very interesting, because yesterday they were talking about the ban, because we have a ban. It's very helpful, Madam Secretary. Is that right? Without the ban, we'd have a bigger problem. We have a ban on certain areas, certain countries, depending on what's going on in the world.
And then he went here.
Prime Minister Abe of Japan gave me the most beautiful copy of a letter that he sent to the people who give out a thing called the Nobel Prize. He said, I have nominated you, or respectfully, on behalf of Japan, I am asking them to give you the Nobel Peace Prize. I said, thank you. Many other people feel that way, too. I'll probably never get it, but that's okay. They gave it to Obama. He didn't even know what he got it for. He was there for about 15 seconds, and he got the Nobel Prize. He said, oh, what did I get it for? With me, I probably will never get it. But if you look at Idlib province in Syria, I stopped the slaughter of perhaps 3 million people. Nobody talk about that. They don't talk about that. Russia and Iran and Syria were going to go in and perhaps destroy 3 million people in order to get 45,000 terrorists. And I heard about it from a woman who had her parents and her brothers living there. And she said, please, please. And I thought, I said, no, it can't happen. What are you talking about? No, they're going to get. And I come home and I read a certain paper where the story was there that they were actually forming to go into, to really do big destruction. And I put out a statement that you better not do it.
Now, reports from Japanese media confirmed that the Nobel nomination was made at the request of the Trump administration. Of course it was. And on February 14th, the Senate, with an ill-fated vote of 54-45, confirmed William Barr as Attorney General, I guess granting Donald Trump his wish for his own personal Roy Cohn. Yeah, we'll get there too. And yes, there was another mass shooting in Aurora, Illinois. Ah, February. More Democrats threw their hats into the presidential ring, including Jay Inslee, John Hickenlooper, Beto O'Rourke, and Kirsten Gillibrand. And that brings us to March. In March, as expected, Trump vetoed Congress's bill regarding his declaration of a national emergency at the Mexico border. And the House, well, failed to overturn the veto. Meanwhile, lobbyist and former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort was sentenced in Virginia to 47 months in prison for bank fraud, filing false tax returns, and failure to file reports of foreign bank and financial accounts. But wait, there's more. The following week, Manafort was sentenced to an additional 43 months in prison for conspiracy against the United States and conspiracy to obstruct justice in the District of Columbia. Donald Trump only hires the best people. Now, although John McCain passed away last year, Trump, for some reason, escalated his attacks on the late senator and former Republican presidential nominee while speaking at the Lima Army Tank Plant in Ohio.
So John McCain left it. I endorsed him at his request, and I gave him the kind of funeral that he wanted, which as president, I had to approve. I don't care about this. I didn't get thank you. That's okay. We sent him on the way, but I wasn't a fan of John McCain. So now what we could say is, now we're all set. I don't think I have to answer that question, but the press keeps, what do you think of McCain? What do you think? Not my kind of guy, but some people like him, and I think that's great.
President, why are you attacking Senator John McCain?
I'm very unhappy that he didn't repeal and replace Obamacare, as you know. He campaigned on repealing and replacing Obamacare for years. And then he got to a vote and he said, thumbs down. And our country would have saved $1 trillion and we would have had great health care. So he campaigned. He told us hours before that he was going to repeal and replace. And then for some reason, I think I understand the reason, he ended up going thumbs up. And frankly, had we even known that, I think we would have gotten a vote because we could have gotten somebody else. So I think that's disgraceful. Plus, there are other things. I was never a fan of John McCain, and I never will be. Thank you very much, everybody.
What a sad little man. On March 22nd, Robert Mueller delivered his long-awaited report, but he delivered it to the Attorney General, William Barr, who 2 days later released a letter summarizing his take on the principal conclusions from the Mueller probe. According to Barr's 4-page letter, the evidence was not sufficient to establish that members of Trump's campaign tacitly engaged in a criminal conspiracy with the Russian government to interfere with the election. We'd soon learn that Barr was gaslighting America. It was almost a month later when we finally got to draw our own conclusions about the Mueller report. On April 18th, a redacted version was released, though the damage had already been done when the Attorney General issued a false description. And that was the only take on the report available to the public between March 22nd and April 18th. In April, the floodgates of Democratic presidential hopefuls opened wider with Tim Ryan, Eric Swalwell, Pete Buttigieg, Seth Moulton, and Joe Biden all announcing their bids.
I believe history will look back on 4 years of this president and all he embraces as an aberrant moment in time. But if we give Donald Trump 8 years in the White House, he will forever and fundamentally alter the character of this nation, who we are. And I cannot stand by and watch that happen. The core values of this nation, our standing in the world, our very democracy, everything that has made America America is at stake. That's why today I'm announcing my candidacy for President of the United States.
So it's the middle of April. Tax day came and went with no sign of any of Trump's tax returns, despite his many promises to release them.
If I decide to run for office, I'll produce my tax returns. Absolutely.
I'm releasing when we're finished with the audit. I will release my tax returns against my lawyer's wishes. When she releases her 33,000 emails,
I'll release them when the audit's completed.
As soon as that's finished, whenever that may be, and hopefully it's going to be before the election, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, right.
Mr. President, the chairman of the Democratic House Ways and Means Committee moments ago asked the IRS for 6 years of your tax returns.
Is that all?
That's all.
Oh, usually it's 10, so I guess they're giving up. Now, we're under audit. Despite what people said, and we're working that out, as I'm always under audit, it seems. But I've been under audit for many years because the numbers are big, and I guess when you have a name, you're audited. But until such time as I'm not under audit, I would not be inclined to do that. Thank you.
Julian Assange was arrested in April at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he had been holed up since 2012. Donald Trump, throughout the campaign, sang the WikiLeaks praises.
WikiLeaks! I love WikiLeaks.
We love WikiLeaks. Boy, they have really... WikiLeaks! They have revealed a lot.
Yes, WikiLeaks! 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 Now from WikiLeaks.
Did you see what came out over WikiLeaks?
Oh, we love WikiLeaks.
We've learned so much from WikiLeaks.
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 WikiLeaks just came out with lots of really unbelievable things.
WikiLeaks.
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 WikiLeaks. Again, nobody's covering WikiLeaks.
Of course, after Assange was arrested, he became Sergeant Schultz. I know nothing.
WikiLeaks.
I know nothing about WikiLeaks. It's not my thing.
Right. May was a pretty devastating month, filled with what felt like nonstop mass shootings. On May 1st, a student who hadn't been to class in a week opened fire on his classmates at University of North Carolina in Charlotte. Two students were killed and four more were injured. The shooter was taken into custody. On May 7th, the school shooting in Highlands Ranch, Colorado, left one student dead and another eight injured. Two suspects were taken into custody, a male and an underage female, both suspected to be students. The victim who died trying to save other students. On May 26th, at least 10 people in Virginia were shot, one fatally, at a Memorial Day gathering that night. And on May 31st, 12 people were killed in Virginia Beach after a disgruntled city employee entered a municipal building with a gun. All but one of the victims were city employees. The suspect was a current employee who had been there for 15 years. He died from police gunfire. And then there were more. Michael Bennett, Steve Bullock, and Bill de Blasio all announced their presidential bids in May. Finally, on May 29th, Robert Mueller delivered his first public statement about the Russia investigation. He says charging Trump with a crime was not an option the office could consider.
We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime. The introduction to the Volume 2 of our report explains that decision. It explains that under long-standing department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office. That is unconstitutional. Even if the charge is kept under seal and hidden from public view, that too is prohibited. The special counsel's office is part of the Department of Justice, and by regulation, it was bound by that department policy. Charging the president with a crime was therefore not an option we could consider.
And then he explained that the report did not exonerate Donald Trump.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so.
Mueller then announced the special counsel's office would be closing and he'd be resigning from the Department of Justice. In June, Donald Trump proved that he understands absolutely nothing about conflicts of interest, campaign finance law, or why it's wrong to accept any help from a foreign government in a campaign. In a rare interview with someone not on Fox, Trump spent a day talking to ABC's George Stephanopoulos and somewhat incredulously admitted he'd continue breaking the law.
And then the report comes out and they didn't even say, they hardly even talked about it.
Should he have gone to the FBI when he got that email?
Okay, let's put yourself in a position. You're a congressman. Somebody comes up and says, hey, I have information on your opponent. Do you call the FBI?
I don't think it's coming from
Russia.
I'll tell
you what, I've seen a lot of things over my life. I don't think in my whole life I've ever called the FBI. In my whole life. You don't call the FBI. You throw somebody out of your office. You do whatever
you do. Al Gore got a stolen briefing book. He called the FBI.
Well, that's different, a stolen briefing book. This isn't a stolen. This is somebody that said, we have information on your opponent. Oh, let me call the FBI. Give me a break. Life doesn't work that way.
The FBI director says that's what should happen.
The FBI director is wrong.
Your campaign this time around, if foreigners, if Russia, if China, if someone else offers you information on an opponent, should they accept it or should they call the FBI?
I think maybe you do both. I think you might want to listen. There's nothing wrong with listening. If somebody called from a country, Norway, we have information on your opponent. Oh, I think I'd want to hear it.
You want that kind of interference in our elections?
It's not an interference. They have information. I think I'd take it. If I thought there was something wrong, I'd go maybe to the FBI if I thought there was something wrong. But when somebody comes up with OPPO research, right, they come up with OPPO research. Oh, let's call the FBI. The FBI doesn't have enough agents to take care of it. But you go and talk honestly to congressmen. They all do it. They always have. And that's the way it is. It's called OPPO research.
The next day, he went on Fox and Fiends to, well, try to do damage control. And yeah, did what he does best. He lied about what he said.
Essentially, you say there is nothing wrong, in your estimation, with accepting dirt from Russia or any foreign country. You've taken a lot of heat from the Democrats regarding
well,
that since then.
I don't say that. I think it was accurately stated, and I've had a lot of support.
Well, then clarify it.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a lot of support. First of all, I don't think anybody would present me with anything, Ben, because they know how much I love this country. Nobody's going to present me with anything, Ben. Number two, if I was, and of course you have to look at it, because if you don't look at it, you're not going to know if it's bad. How are you going to know if it's bad? But of course you'd give it to the FBI or report it to the Attorney General or somebody like that. But of course you do that. You couldn't have that happen with our country, and everybody understands that. And I thought it was made clear. In fact, I actually said at the beginning, I think I said I'd do both. But how are you going to, if you don't hear what it is, you're not going to know what it is. I mean,
that's
how can you report
how
something?
How do you know it's bad if you don't listen to it?
On the 18th of June, Trump held a rally in Orlando to officially launch his reelection campaign. Meanwhile, the first televised debates of the 2020 presidential cycle were held in Miami over two nights to accommodate 20 candidates who qualified. On June 30th, Trump met North Korean leader Kim Jong-un at the Korean Demilitarized Zone, becoming the first sitting U.S. president to ever enter North Korea. And he also became the first sitting U.S. president to be completely owned by the North Korean dictator. Trump again lied, claiming
President Obama wanted to meet, and Chairman Kim would not meet him. The Obama administration was begging for a meeting. They were begging for meetings constantly, and Chairman Kim would not meet with him. And for some reason, we have a certain chemistry or whatever.
And if it's a month in the calendar, there were more mass shootings. On June 23rd, 11 people were shot, one fatally, at a bar in South Bend, Indiana. Mayor Pete Buttigieg temporarily suspended his presidential campaign to go home and deal with the aftermath. Now, ever since Donald Trump attended the Bastille Day celebration in France during his first year in office, he's fantasized about having his own huge military parade marching down Pennsylvania Avenue. His grandiose plans for the 4th of July were finally killed off by the adults in the room, but Trump wasn't deterred. He instead commandeered the always apolitical Washington, D.C. 4th of July celebration and gave a speech that showed his vast knowledge of American history, or not.
In June of 1775, the Continental Congress created a unified army out of the revolutionary forces encamped around Boston and New York, and named after the great George Washington, Commander-in-Chief. The Continental Army suffered a bitter winter of Valley Forge, found glory across the waters of the Delaware, and seized victory from Cornwallis of Yorktown. Our army manned the airport. It ran the ramparts. It took over the airports. It did everything it had to do. And at Fort McHenry, under the rocket's red glare, it had nothing but victory. And when dawn came, their star-spangled banner waved defiant.
Huh? On July 6th, Donald Trump's one-time friend, Jeffrey Epstein, you know, the billionaire, he was arrested and accused of sex trafficking of minors. There was lots of 2020 action in July. On July 8th, Eric Swalwell announced he's dropping out of the race. And on July 9th, former hedge fund manager Tom Steyer announced he's jumping in. All righty then. On July 14th, Donald Trump took to Twitter, as he tends to do, this time to publicly smear four members of Congress who have collectively become known as the Squad, telling freshman Congresswomen Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, and Ayanna Pressley to, quote, go back to their home countries. Yeah, he did. Ocasio-Cortez, Tlaib, and Pressley are all natural-born U.S. citizens. Ilhan Omar was born in Somalia, immigrated to the U.S. as a child, and became a citizen. 2 days after his Twitter storm, the House voted 240 to 187 to condemn the language Trump used in his tweets about the Squad. But of course, on that same day, he continued his attacks while talking to reporters.
Three of the congresswomen that you talked about, going back to fix the problems, what were you talking about?
Well, they're very unhappy. I'm watching them. All they do is complain. So all I'm saying is, if they want to leave, they can leave, John. They can leave. I mean, I look at the one, I look at Omar. I don't know. I never met her. I hear the way she talks about Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda has killed many Americans. She said, you can hold your chest out. You can, when I think of America, huh? When I think of Al-Qaeda, I can hold my chest out. When she talked about the World Trade Center being knocked down, some people, you remember the famous some people? These are people that, in my opinion, hate our country. Now, you can say what you want, but get a list of all of the statements they've made. And all I'm saying that if they're not happy here, they can leave. They can leave, and you know what? I'm sure that there'll be many people that won't miss them.
But they're American citizens.
But they have to love, they have to love our country. They're Congress people, and I never used any names.
Are you
but
okay
these are people,
with
quiet,
your
quiet,
tweets are
quiet,
racist, Mr. President?
Quiet.
Are you okay with people
quiet.
Thinking your tweets are racist, sir?
Quiet. These I'm are people question, that if they don't like it here, they can leave.
He kept going, but that's enough of that. So it's no wonder that at a rally that very night, the crowd started chanting, send her back.
And obviously and importantly, Omar has a history of launching vicious anti-Semitic screeds.
Ugh. On July 24th, the long-awaited testimony before Congress from Robert Mueller happened. Unfortunately, Mueller was not quite the strong witness we had been expecting, and his testimony was severely undermined by Attorney General Barr's mischaracterization of the Mueller probe's findings. The very next day after Mueller testified, July 25th, an emboldened Donald Trump spoke on the phone with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Trump asked Zelensky for a favor, though, encouraging him to speak with Rudolph Giuliani about investigating Joe Biden. In the days before the call, Trump had blocked nearly $400 million in military and security aid to Ukraine. We certainly didn't know it at the time, but that phone call directly led to the impeachment of Donald J. Trump. I know I said earlier that May was the month of mass shootings. Well, May was outdone by July. July began with two mall shootings. On the first, four people were injured after gunfire erupted in a San Francisco mall. Thankfully, all the victims were expected to make a recovery. On July 2nd, at least two people were injured after someone opened gunfire at a North Carolina mall. Then on July 26th, Four people were left dead and two wounded after a man went on a shooting spree in three Los Angeles neighborhoods. After a 12-hour manhunt, police were able to detain the suspect. But wait, there's more. On July 27th, a festival in Brownsville, Brooklyn ended in chaos. Gunfire killed one person and left another 11 injured. And on July 28th, three people, including the shooter, died, and another 12 were injured after gunshots rang out at California's Gilroy Garlic Festival. And still nothing has been done to stem the gun epidemic in this country. And the shooting spree didn't end in July. In fact, the first week of August brought two mass shootings in just 24 hours. On August 3rd, a gunman entered a Walmart in El Paso, Texas, killing 20 people and injuring another 26. The shooting was determined to be a hate crime against Mexican immigrants and nationals. A 21-year-old suspect was later arrested and investigated for domestic terrorism. And on August 3rd, just 13 hours later, a gunman opened fire in a bar in Dayton, Ohio. He killed 9 people and injured another 27. The gunman was pronounced dead by police gunfire, and no motive was immediately clear.
Maybe it's the car phone, maybe it's the fertilizer, maybe it's the nutrients, maybe it's the ends, but I know one thing. If it were up to me, I'd take away the guns. I'd take away the guns.
When Donald Trump finally emerged to say something about the carnage, he, of course, got it wrong.
We will ensure that those who were attacked will not have died in vain. May God bless the memory of those who perished in Toledo. May God protect them. May God protect all of those from Texas to Ohio. May God bless the victims and their families. May God bless America. Thank you very much. Thank you.
No, Donald, it wasn't Toledo. It was Dayton. Is it that difficult to get the name of the city where people were gunned down right? I guess for him it is. On August 10th, Jeffrey Epstein was found dead in his prison cell. The sexual predator and child abuser was arrested in July and was ostensibly on a suicide watch because of a prior suicide attempt. Although officials say it was suicide, not everyone believes that, and it's still under investigation by the FBI. Portland, Oregon was the site of sometimes violent clashes between far-right groups and anti-fascists. The president showed no concern over the far-right, hate group, white nationalists, Nazis, those kind of people, but he went on a rampage against Antifa, which literally stands for anti-fascist.
The day of tension began with a demonstration staged by far-right groups led by a militant organization called the Proud Boys. They were heavily outnumbered by Antifa, their supporters, and peaceful protesters expressing opposition to far-right groups. A heavy police presence covered the area. Officers seized shields, poles, and bear spray from protesters. Many Portland residents were upset that far-right demonstrators came to their liberal, left-leaning city to cause trouble.
As far as somebody coming here and getting a group together just to fight, oh, that's messed up.
A short time after the Proud Boys and their supporters arrived in the park, tensions rose.
You can see that the groups of anti-fascist protesters have gathered here underneath this bridge. To the other side there, across that green lawn, the far right and neo-fascist groups have gathered. They're being kept apart by the police, and the hope is that the police presence will keep these two sides from engaging in any violence.
President Donald Trump inserted himself in the affair, tweeting that Antifa might be named an organization of terror, but he had no criticism of neo-fascist or far-right groups. Proud Boys leader Joe Biggs was pleased by Trump's message.
Go look at President Trump's Twitter. He talked about Portland, said he's watching Antifa. That's all we wanted. We wanted national attention on it. We got it.
Let's just get this straight. Trump praises the fascists, but rails against those against fascism. Got it. There was lots of 2020 action in August. John Hickenlooper dropped out and decided to run for Senate from Colorado. Jay Inslee dropped out, followed by Seth Moulton and Kirsten Gillibrand. And August ended the same way it began, with two more mass shootings. On August 30th, a high school football game in Alabama ended with gunfire. An estimated 10 students were injured, half of whom are believed to have critical injuries. And the next day, on August 31st, a man in West Texas began shooting from his car and later from a hijacked mail truck. The suspect caused 21 injuries and 5 deaths. Police engaged in a shootout, eventually killing the suspect. In September, the Pentagon diverted $3.6 billion in military construction funds to build Donald Trump's stupid wall. Actress Felicity Huffman was sentenced to 14 days in prison for her role in a college admission cheating scandal. She also has to serve a year of probation, perform 250 hours of community service, and pay a $30,000 fine. Aunt Becky, also known as Lori Loughlin, is still awaiting her trial after pleading not guilty. Here comes 2020. On September 15th, Purdue Pharmaceuticals, the maker of the painkiller OxyContin, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in New York as part of its plan to settle with dozens of states and other plaintiffs who say the company fueled the opioid crisis. So that happened. On September 16th, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office subpoenaed 8 years of Donald Trump's tax returns from his accounting firm as part of its investigation into hush money payments. That case is still working its way through the courts. On September 20th, Bill de Blasio dropped out of the presidential race. And on September 24th, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi announced the launch of a formal impeachment inquiry into Donald Trump. The following day, we learned that a whistleblower in the Trump administration released information about that July 25th phone call between Trump and Ukrainian President Zelensky, saying that in the call, Trump appeared to ask President Zelensky to investigate the son of Joe Biden, a potential opponent to Trump in 2020. One of the best attempts by a journalist to get a straight answer from Trump in 2019 came after the call memo was released. Jeff Mason of Reuters wins the award for perseverance and pushback against a guy who just refuses to answer the question he was asked.
Can you just make clear right here, what do you or what did you want President Zelensky to do with regard to Joe and Hunter Biden?
If you look at what he said, okay? And he brought it up. I think he brought up the name Rudy Giuliani. What I want is the following. And I've said this loud and clear. We have our ambassadors here. We have Mike Pence here. Why are we the only ones that give the big money to the Ukraine? We give money to Ukraine. And it's bothered me from day one. And you have plenty of people just here. I say, how come it's always the United States that gets ripped? Frankly, Ukraine, we want to help them. And I do like the new president. You know why I like him? Because he was honest. Because he said there was no pressure at all exerted on me, meaning him, by the president of the United States. He said it. By the way, that one sentence should stop this.
What about Mr. Biden? What did you want about Biden? What did you want him to look into on Biden?
Look, Biden and his son are stone cold crooked. And you know it. His son walks out with millions of dollars. The kid knows nothing. You know it, and so do we. Go ahead, ask a question.
The question, sir, was what did you want President Zelensky to do about Vice President Biden and his son, Hunter?
Are you talking to me?
Yeah, it was just a follow-up of what I just asked you, sir.
Listen, you ready? We have the President of Finland. Ask him a question.
I have one for him. I just wanted to follow up on the one that I asked you, which was,
did you hear me?
What did you want him to
do? Did you hear me?
Yes,
sir. Ask him a question.
I will, but
I've given you a long answer. Ask this gentleman a question. Don't be rude.
No, sir, I don't want to be rude. I just wanted you to have a chance to answer the question that I asked
I've
you.
I've answered everything. It's a whole hoax. And you know who's playing into the hoax? People like you and the fake news media that we have in this country. And I say in many cases, the corrupt media, because you're corrupt. Much of the media in this country is not just fake, it's corrupt. And you have some very fine people, too. Great journalists, great reporters. But it, to a large extent, it's corrupt and it's fake. Ask the president of Finland a question, please.
Okay, I'll move on now. Mr. President.
The problem is he doesn't think he did anything wrong. And if that wasn't frightening enough, Trump continued his downward spiral to the point where he essentially suggested that the whistleblower be shot.
But basically, that person never saw the report, never saw the call, meaning never saw the call, heard something and decided that he or she, whoever the hell it is, sort of like almost a spy. I want to know who's the person that gave the whistleblower, who's the person that gave the whistleblower the information, because that's close to a spy. You know what we used to do in the old days when we were smart, right, with spies and treason, right? We used to handle it a little differently than we do now.
In October, we learned that Bernie Sanders had suffered a heart attack. He had two stents inserted in a procedure and was soon back on the road. And on December 30th, Sanders released letters from three doctors proclaiming him completely healthy and fit to run and to serve. Of course, October is another month, so why should it be any different? Of course, there were more mass shootings. On October 6th, police continued to search for two suspects in a Kansas City bar shooting, which left four people dead and another five wounded. On October 12th, the shooting at a social club in Brooklyn left four people dead and another three wounded. Police apparently still have no suspect. On October 13th, six people were rushed to the hospital after a shooting on a Philadelphia highway. This was the third mass shooting in Pennsylvania in a week. And on October 21st, another shooting in Pennsylvania led to the death of a two-year-old and critical injuries of an 11-month-old. But wait, there's more. On October 26th, two students at Texas A&M were killed after a gunman opened fire at an off-campus homecoming party, and 10 more were injured. The very next day, on October 27th, a vigil was held for the two students where shots were fired. Thankfully, no one was injured. And then on October 29th, 12 people were shot at a house party in Long Beach, California. And so it goes. Oh, and Tim Ryan dropped out of the presidential race at the end of October, followed by Beto O'Rourke on November 1st. But another one entered. This time, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick is in. And before November would end, former New York City mayor and multi-billionaire Michael Bloomberg would also throw his hat in the ring. Go figure. On November 13th, public impeachment hearings into Donald Trump's presidency began in the House Judiciary Committee under Chairman Adam Schiff. Over 5 days, we heard from 12 witnesses. First up was William Taylor. He's the top American diplomat in Ukraine who was tapped by the Trump administration to replace the ousted former ambassador, Marie Yovanovitch.
By mid-July, it was becoming clear to me that the meeting President Zelensky wanted was conditioned on the investigations of Burisma and alleged Ukrainian interference in the 2016 U.S. elections. It was also clear that this condition was driven by the irregular policy channel I had come to understand was guided by Mr. Giuliani. In a regular NSC secure video conference call on July 18th, I heard a staff person from the Office of Management and Budget say that there was a hold on security assistance to Ukraine, but could not say why. Toward the end of an otherwise normal meeting, a voice on the call, the person was off screen, said that she was from OMB and her boss had instructed her not to approve any additional spending on security assistance for Ukraine until further notice. I and others sat in astonishment. The Ukrainians were fighting Russians and counted on not only the training and weapons, but also the assurance of U.S. support. All that the OMB staff person said was that the directive had come from the president to the chief of staff to OMB. In an instant, I realized that one of the key pillars of our strong support for Ukraine was threatened. the irregular policy channel was running contrary to the goals of longstanding U.S. policy.
Also testifying that first day was George Kent, the senior State Department official in charge of Ukraine, who was so alarmed by Trump's efforts to initiate, quote, politically motivated prosecutions, that he wrote a memo about it weeks before the anonymous whistleblower's complaint prompted the investigation.
I would like to conclude my opening remarks with an observation about some of my fellow public servants who have come under personal attacks. Ambassador Yovanovitch, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, and Dr. Hill, at least one of whom is going to appear before this body in the coming days. Masha, Alex, and Fiona were born abroad before their families or they themselves personally chose to immigrate to the United States. They all made the professional choice to serve the United States as public officials, helping shape our national security policy towards Russia in particular, and we and our national security are the better for it. In this sense, they are the 21st century heirs of two giants of 20th century U.S. national security policy who also were born abroad, my former professor Zbigniew Brzezinski and his fellow immigrant Henry Kissinger. Like the Brzezinskis and Kissingers, the Yovanovitches and Vindmans fled Nazi and communist oppression to contribute to a stronger, more secure America. That honorable tradition of transatlantic ties goes back to the very founding of our republic. Our 18th century independence would not have been secured without the choice of European officers, the French-born Lafayette and Rochambeau, the German-born von Steuben, and the Poles Pulaski and Kosciuszko, to come to the New World and fight for our cause of freedom and the birth of a new country free from imperial dominion. It is my privilege to sit next to my former boss, Ambassador Taylor, today. And it is my honor to serve with all of these patriotic Americans.
The second day of testimony, Friday, November 15th, had only one witness, the aforementioned ousted ambassador, Marie Yovanovitch, who was denigrated by Donald Trump to President Zelensky, and it's all there in that call transcript.
And prior to reading that call record, were you aware that President Trump had specifically made reference to you in that call?
No.
What was your reaction to learning that?
I was shocked. Absolutely shocked and devastated, frankly.
What do you mean by devastated?
I was shocked and devastated that I would feature in a phone call between two heads of state in such a manner where President Trump said that I was bad news to another world leader. And that I would be going through some things. It was a terrible moment. A person who saw me actually reading the transcript said that the color drained from my face. I think I even had a physical reaction. I think, you know, even now, words kind of fail me.
Well, without upsetting you too much, I'd like to show you the excerpts from the call. And the first one, where President Trump says, the former ambassador from the United States, the woman, was bad news, and the people she was dealing with in the Ukraine were bad news. So I just want to let you know. What was your reaction when you heard the president of the United States refer to you as bad news?
I couldn't believe it. I mean, again, shocked, appalled, devastated that the President of the United States would talk about any ambassador like that to a foreign head of state, and it was me. I mean, I couldn't believe it.
The next excerpt, when the President references you, was a short one, but he said, well, she's going to go through some things. What did you think when President Trump told President Zelensky and you read that you were going to go through some things?
I didn't know what to think, but I was very concerned.
What were you concerned about?
She's going to go through some things. It didn't sound good. It sounded like a threat.
Did you feel threatened?
I did.
Day three was on Tuesday, November 19th, and there were two sessions. In the morning session, we heard from Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, the top Ukraine expert on the National Security Council, and Jennifer Williams, special advisor to Vice President Mike Pence on European and Russian affairs. The afternoon session featured Kurt Volker, who was U.S. Special Representative to Ukraine under Trump until his resignation in September, and Timothy Morrison, who took over for the ousted Fiona Hill, another upcoming witness, until his resignation on October 31st. Adam Schiff questioned Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, who was one of the people listening in on that July 25th phone call in real time.
About 2 weeks after that July 10th meeting, President Trump and President Zelensky had their second call, the now infamous July 25th call. Colonel Vindman, what was your real-time reaction to hearing that call?
Chairman, without hesitation, I knew that I had to report this to the White House counsel. I had concerns, and it was my duty to report my concerns to the proper people in the chain of command.
And what was your concern?
Well, Chairman, as I said in my statement, it was inappropriate, it was improper for the president to request and to demand an investigation into a political opponent, especially a foreign power where there's at best dubious belief that this would be a completely impartial investigation and that this would have significant implications if it became public knowledge and it would be perceived as a partisan play. It would undermine our Ukraine policy and it would undermine our national security.
Now, Colonel, you've described this as a demand, this favor that the president asked. What is it about the relationship between the President of the United States and the President of Ukraine that leads you to conclude that when the President of the United States asks a favor like this, it's really a demand?
Chairman, the culture I come from, the military culture, when a senior asks you to do something, even if it's polite and pleasant, it's not to be taken as a request. It's to be taken as an order. In this case, the power disparity between the two leaders, my impression is that in order to get the White House meeting, President Zelensky would have to deliver these investigations.
The following day was another doubleheader. Actually, if you count that evening's Democratic candidates' debate, it was a tripleheader. Regardless, it was a long day that featured three witnesses. In the morning session, Gordon Sondland was at the table alone. He's the businessman who contributed $1 million to the Trump inaugural committee and was magically named U.S. ambassador to the European Union. Funny how that happens. He was one of the so-called three amigos who, along with Kurt Volker, who we heard from the day before, and Secretary of Energy Rick Perry, were tasked with running Ukraine policy for the president. Sondland is still in his position, shockingly, as he offered some pretty damning testimony.
I know that members of this committee frequently frame these complicated issues in the form of a simple question. Was there a quid pro quo? As I testified previously, with regard to the requested White House call and the White House meeting, the answer is yes. Mr. Giuliani conveyed to Secretary Perry, Ambassador Volker, and others that President Trump wanted a public statement from President Zelensky committing to investigations of Burisma and the 2016 election. Mr. Giuliani expressed those requests directly to the Ukrainians, and Mr. Giuliani also expressed those requests directly to us. We all understood that these prerequisites for the White House call and the right White House meeting reflected President Trump's desires and requirements.
That afternoon, Laura Cooper, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russian, Ukrainian, and Eurasian Affairs, and David Hale, Undersecretary of State for State and Political Affairs, were the two witnesses. The Intelligence Committee hearings concluded on November 21st with David Holmes, a State Department official who serves as counselor for political affairs at the embassy in Ukraine, and Dr. Fiona Hill, the National Security Council's former senior director for the European Union in Russia. David Holmes is the man who told about overhearing a phone conversation between Donald Trump and Gordon Sondland.
You went to lunch, and can you just describe where you were sitting at the restaurant?
Yes, sir. The restaurant has sort of glass doors that open onto a terrace. And we were at the first tables on the terrace, so immediately outside of the interior of the restaurant. The doors were all wide open. There was a table for four, although I recall it being two tables for two pushed together. In any case, it was quite a wide table. And the table was set with sort of a table runner down the middle. I was directly across from Ambassador Sondland. We were close enough that we could, you know, share an appetizer between us, and then the two staffers were off to our right at this next table.
Now, you said that at some point Ambassador Sondland pulled out his cell phone and called President Trump. This was an unsecure cell phone, is that right?
Yes, sir.
In the middle of a restaurant in Kyiv?
Yes.
You said that you were able to hear President Trump's voice through the receiver. How were you able to hear if it was not on speakerphone?
Several things. It was quite loud when the president came on, quite distinctive. I believe Ambassador Sondland also said yesterday he often speaks very loudly over the phone, and I certainly experienced that. When the president came on, he sort of winced and held the phone away from his ear like this, and he did that for the first couple exchanges. I don't know if he then turned the volume down, if he got used to it, if the president moderated his volume. I don't know, but that's how I was able to hear it.
And so you were able to hear some of what President Trump said to President Zelensky, is that right?
The first portion of the conversation, yes.
And what did you hear President Trump say to Ambassador Sondland?
He clarified whether he was in Ukraine or not, and he said, yes, I'm here in Ukraine. And then Ambassador Sondland said, he loves your ass, he'll do anything you want. He said, is he going to do the investigation?
So you heard President Trump ask Ambassador Sondland, is he going to do the investigation?
Yes, sir.
What was Ambassador Sondland's response?
He said, oh, yeah, he's going to do it. He'll do anything you ask.
And the final very powerful witness for this round of hearings was Dr. Fiona Hill.
Based on questions and statements I've heard, some of you on this committee appear to believe that Russia and its security services did not conduct a campaign against our country, and that perhaps, somehow, for some reason, Ukraine did. This is a fictional narrative that has been perpetrated and propagated by the Russian security services themselves. The unfortunate truth is that Russia was the foreign power that systematically attacked our democratic institutions in 2016. This is the public conclusion of our intelligence agencies, confirmed in bipartisan congressional reports. It is beyond dispute, even if some of the underlying details must remain classified. The impact of the successful 2016 Russian campaign remains evident today. Our nation is being torn apart. Truth is questioned. Our highly professional and expert Korea Foreign Service is being undermined. U.S. support for Ukraine, which continues to face armed Russian aggression, has been politicized. The Russian government's goal is to weaken our country, to diminish America's global role, and to neutralize a perceived U.S. threat to Russian interests. President Putin and the Russian security services aim to counter U.S. foreign policy objectives in Europe, including in Ukraine, where Moscow wishes to reassert political and economic dominance. I say this not as an alarmist, but as a realist. I do not think long-term conflict with Russia is either desirable or inevitable. I continue to believe that we need to seek ways of stabilizing our relationship with Moscow, even as we counter their efforts to harm us. Right now, Russia's security services and their proxies have geared up to repeat their interference in the 2020 election. We are running out of time to stop them. In the course of this investigation, I would ask that you please not promote politically driven falsehoods that so clearly advance Russian interests.
And that brings us to December.
A long December, and there's reason to believe maybe this year will be better than.
A few of the Democratic hopefuls dropped out in December. Joe Sestak, Steve Bullock, and Kamala Harris all bowed out. But let's get back to the impeachment. The House Judiciary Committee held its own hearings that began December 4th with four law professors, Harvard's Noah Feldman, Stanford's Pamela Karlan, and the University of North Carolina's Michael Gearhart were all invited as witnesses for the Democrats. George Washington University's Jonathan Turley was the lone Republican witness. The first three were all asked, based on the House Intelligence Committee evidence, did President Trump commit the impeachable high crime and misdemeanor of abuse of power? All said that he did, with Gearhart adding this.
If what we're talking about is not impeachable, then nothing is impeachable. This is precisely the misconduct that the framers created a constitution, including impeachment, to protect against. And if there's no action, if Congress concludes they're going to give a pass to the president here, as Professor Carlin suggested earlier, every other president will say, okay, then I can do the same thing, and the boundaries will just evaporate. And those boundaries are set up by the Constitution, and we may be witnessing, unfortunately, their erosion. And that is a danger to all of us.
While the three professors invited by the Democrats backed impeachment, Jonathan Turley argued that Democrats were making a mistake by pursuing a, quote, slipshod impeachment that would have long-lasting consequences. The committee met again for a marathon 9.5 hours on Monday, December 9th, in which counsel for both sides laid out their cases on why Trump should or should not be impeached. The White House refused to cooperate in this or any of the hearings that were held, instructed subpoenaed witnesses not to comply, and refused to hand over any documents that were all under subpoena. Then, on December 10th, the United States House of Representatives unveiled two articles of impeachment, one for abuse of power, the other for obstruction of Congress. And on December 18th, the House of Representatives voted to impeach Donald Trump, charging a president with high crimes and misdemeanors for only the third time in American history.
On this vote, the yeas are 230, the nays are 197, present is one. Article 1 is adopted. On this vote, the yeas are 229, the nays are 198, present is one. Article 2 is adopted.
And here we are at the end of another difficult and tumultuous year, with Mitch McConnell and other Republicans openly declaring that they will not be impartial jurors and fighting the idea of even calling any witnesses. Nancy Pelosi is holding on to those articles of impeachment instead of sending them to the Senate, as procedure dictates, until, she says, she knows that the trial will be a fair one. So 2020 is, at this point, a question mark. We'll hear it unfold together. I'm Nicole Sandler, and I'll do my best to keep speaking truth to power and questioning authority. I wish us all a very happy, healthy, and prosperous new year. And may 2020 rid us of Donald Trump once and for all. Thank you for listening and supporting this show and independent progressive media. Happy New Year.
Yes, wishing you the bluest sky and hoping something better comes tomorrow. Hoping all the verses rhyme and the very best of chorus has to follow on. The verses rhyme, and the very best of choruses too.